Alright. So I'm very happy to meet you, everyone. No. You will have to bear with my French accent, you know. Although I come from Switzerland, you know, but I come from the French part, so. So, yeah. Okay, so you just relax. And for those which have, you know, refuge in some higher dimension, you know, for enlightened beings or an enlightened energy. So I'll chant the refuge in Sanskrit. So those which know, they can join in. And that one, they just, you know, open their heart to this, you know, to space and to light and to goodness, to love, and compassion, and open their heart to this higher energy. And then after that, usually I chant the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of Chenrezig. So then we try to open our heart for towards each and every one of us, and towards our family member, our children, our parents, our community, and to all living beings. You know, we open our heart that we care for them and that we wish to become a better person for their sake. So the refuge prayer is, you know, Namo Guru Bhya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya. The same that we found in the Guru Yoga. And those which know can join in the other one. Just open your heart to this higher dimension. So in you inhale all the blessing from all the enlightened beings into you. That blessing manifests in the form of a sphere of light in your heart. And that's the energy of your care for each and everyone. And as we chant the mantra, of loving compassion, you imagine that your heart becomes bigger and bigger, and that you send rays of light of loving kindness towards your neighbor, the people around you, and that you become infinite love, infinite compassion that you radiate out towards all living beings. Because each and everyone is just like us. They just want to be happy. And as I deserve to be happy, each and everyone deserves the same. And on top of that, each and everyone has been infinitely kind towards oneself. Maybe not in this life, but at other time. They've been intimately connected to each and every one of us. They have given us food, shelter, love. We have laughed together. So we care for each and every one. And that feeling of care is the most joyful state of mind that one can experience when one's heart opens up, and that we truly care for others' well-being. We feel like being a really decent human being. And no matter what lifestyle, we feel our life is worthwhile.
Om Mani Padme Om Mani Padme Om 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 Mani Padme Om Om Mani Padme Om Om Mani Padme Om Om Mani Padme Om Mani Padme Om Om Mani Padme Om Om Mani Padme Om. All right. So I'll want to speak a little bit about calm abiding. So first of that, you have there's some certain thing that is good to know in Buddhism. You know, certain views that underlie all the spiritual practice that we try to do. So in Buddhism, this is understanding that there's a fundamental goodness in each one of us, which often is called Buddha nature. So we all have this Buddha nature or this potential to become, you know, omniscient. And that is not like the spiritual path is not something that you have to build up. something that is not there that you have to construct. Like a building, and there's nothing there, and that you have to build the building. So in spiritual practice, it's a little bit the opposite. You see, the mind is fundamentally pure. Like, you see, the example given, you see, is like the sky. You know, the sky is always formless and has no content, nothing, right? And it's the clouds that obscures it, right? So our mind is innately, fundamentally pure, yet we have all these thoughts and emotion and disturbed emotion and this mistaken perception of reality that prevents this pure nature to manifest, right? So the spiritual practice, the spiritual path is more a path of letting go than of building up, you know. Because innately, the purity of, you cannot make your mind more pure than it is, yeah. But you have to remove what obscures that purity to manifest, right? So, so that's, you know, good to understand that everybody has this Buddha nature, this Buddha potential, you know. So some are more disturbed than other or more confused than other, you know. So, the spiritual path is a thing of taming one's own mind. You know, is to understand your mind. What is the mind? You know, where does it come from? Where does it go? What is its nature? What is mind? You know? What is a thought? What is an emotion? How does it function? What's the I, the sense of I? So if you resolve that riddle in yourself, you discover the fundamental purity of your mind. You discover that innately you have always existed and that you will always exist, that you're not this body, you know, that you're something, you know, like space, a space of universal goodness, and that's your true nature. And that, how to say, all your intellectual knowledge, all your realization doesn't make it any better. And all your confusion, you know, all these things doesn't make it worse. So the fundamental nature of the mind is pure as it is, you know. And that's what one discovers gently through, you know, the years of practice, that fundamentally the mind is pure, you know. And when you realize that, you experience that, you start discovering an otherness, you know, what one calls, you know, liberation or enlightenment or, you know. And then we have two types of mind. You have the mind which is in the brain, you know, which thinks, with the rational mind. And then you have the primordial mind which is in your heart. You see? So, often, first we understand the spiritual path through the head, you know, through study, reflection, meditation, often with the head, you know. But the realization doesn't happen here. The realization happens when it sinks to the heart, that you experience it with your heart, you know. So, there's a seeing, an understanding, an experiencing that happens in the heart, which is less dualistic, less conceptual than the head, you know. So then in order for this pure nature of the mind to reveal itself, often there's three types or category of practices that one does, you know. So one is analytical meditation, where one studies a topic and think about it, reflect about it, and get some insight. Let's say, like the preciousness of human life, or how karma functions, or emptiness, how ultimately things exist, you know, or bodhicitta, love and compassion. So you use many tools to enhance those states of mind, right? So this is called analytical meditation. Then you have another type of meditation where you try to stabilize your mind. How to put it? Usually it's called calm abiding or meditative concentration or... You see, if you try to watch your breath or follow an idea or concentrate on an image, you're very quickly distracted by other thoughts, right? So you might be able to stay a few seconds, or those which are very trained can stay a few minutes, you know. But constantly there's another thought coming up, and you jump, you follow that idea for a while, and then you bring it back, and then it goes another, you know, follow another train of thought, and then you bring it back. So constantly the mind is wandering off. That prevents you from staying this sustained attention. Okay? And then there's another disturbance that happens, that you focus on the object, and then actually, you know, there's a dullness, a heaviness of body and mind that makes you forget the object also. So there's either excitement, distraction, or dullness, you know, heaviness, that prevents you to have this sustained attention. Okay? So one trains in this sustained attention if one plays music or in certain sport. You know, you need a great level of sustained attention, you know, in other fields than just meditation, right? And so in certain profession also you need a very sustained attention, right? But often in those fields your senses are involved. You know, it's the senses that meditate. You know, whereas in spiritual practice, it's the mind that you try to tame, to bring to this level of sustained attention. Okay? So, and the third type of practice that are helpful for spiritual development is the devotional type of practice, you know, prayers, chanting, and basically opening one's heart to the blessing of higher being, to a higher dimension. And that actually opens the heart, you know. So that's why in all the spiritual tradition, you know, whether Christianity, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, you know, in any spiritual tradition, in Hinduism it's called Bhakti Yoga, you know, the yoga of devotion, you know, prayer. And it's considered one of the quickest paths. You know, amongst Hinduism, there's many different paths. You know, you have Jnana Yoga, Kundalini Yoga, Raja Yoga, you know, Kama Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. So amongst all those, the Bhakti Yoga is considered quickest. Why? Because by opening your heart, you know, so because the insights, they don't come with the brain. The brain has the intellectual understanding, the knowledge, you know, with thoughts, but it doesn't have a direct perception. Whereas the heart sees things in a non-dualistic way, non-subject and object. You know, for example, when you have an emotion, the things are much more fused. You know, it's not me there. You can actually feel the person with your heart, whereas you can think about the person, you know. So it's a different way of experiencing things. So that's why if you get some kind of heart opening and some blessing, somehow with your heart you can see things much deeper, you know. So that's why you have all this practice of devotion in any spiritual tradition, you know, for opening the heart. Yeah. So basically a well-balanced spiritual practice contains these three elements. You know, the intellectual understanding and the intellectual reasoning, and you're able to develop your mind through the, you know, understanding and thinking about it, and you get certain experience. You can induce certain state of mind due to your reasoning, right? But then in order for that state of mind to become a realization, you must be able to sustain it. Right? So you need a calm, stable mind. You must be able to induce that state of mind and be effortlessly be able to remain in that state of mind. So you need a sustained attention. You need calm abiding. Otherwise, your insight will always be fleeting. You know, you will get to a certain insight, a certain level of love or compassion, but you cannot remain in that state of consciousness because your mind is wandering to other states, to other thoughts. Right? So you need that sustained attention. Right? And then you need some kind of blessing for that to sink very deeply, you know, from your grosser level of mind to more subtle level of consciousness. So that's why a spiritual practice usually combines these three elements, you know, devotional practice, calm abiding, and analytical meditation. So that being said, you know, now tonight we focus on calm abiding, you know. I think most of you know the other types, you know. So I'll try to explain a little bit the pros of calm abiding. I want to sell a good product, you know. So I have to advertise first, you know. So, you know, what you gain if you have calm abiding, right? So, you know. So with calm abiding, if you were able to develop your... So there's 9 level of calm abiding, you know. There's 9 level of development. We'll go over it in this weekend. There's 9 stages. So if you can get to the 5th stage, you know, from 5th stage and above, you start feeling a bliss of body and mind, a pleasure in your meditation. You know, at the beginning, meditation is not so pleasurable. You know, you're constantly distracted somewhere else, you know, and your body is painful here, painful there, oh, you know, kind of like that. And your mind, you know, boop, 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 goes all over, oh, I was supposed to fix my attention there, but I was thinking about my shopping or my problem with my working colleague, and, you know, it's basically, you know, and after 10 minutes, oh, I was supposed to fix my attention there. You know, it's kind of hard work, you know, it's not pleasant, right? But if you keep on developing it, training in it, you reach, you know, quite quickly. Quickly, a certain level. At the first level, basically, you know, you're supposed to fix your attention on the breath for 10 minutes. But actually, during 10 minutes, you're mostly distracted to other things, and you're very rarely there, right? You know, so you know, sometimes, oh yeah, I was supposed to do that, you know, kind of, oh la la, you know, kind of hard, you know, but not possible, you know. Then at the second level, due to training, so on 10 minutes, maybe 4 minutes you're able to stay on it, you know, and 6 minutes you're distracted. So the time you focus on your object is less than the time you're distracted, you know. Then when you reach the third level, you're mostly on the object. You still lose it from time to time, but when you lose it, you know that you're losing it and you're able to bring it back. You know, so, you know, you lose it from time to time, but, you know, you have the you are aware of it and you're able to bring it back. And at the fourth level, one part of your mind for during the 10 minutes never forget the object. You might have subliminal thoughts or subliminal laxity, but one part of your mind during the whole 10-15 minutes is able to stay on the object, and that brings you a certain level of self-confidence and control over your mind. You start becoming in charge of your mind instead of the mind dominating you. You know, you decide something as, now I'm going to do that, and your mind is able to do it. Right? And by continuing that, you reach the 5th level. And at the 5th level, something starts changing in your body and mind. There's a kind of, you see, it's almost like, normally, our energy in the body goes all over the place. You know? And then, by sustaining your attention on an object, the energy in your body starts aligning itself. You know, you start aligning your energy in your body, mind, and that produces a kind of suppleness and a pleasurable sensation in your body and a pleasurable sensation in your mind. You know, and that sensation keeps on growing to the 6, 7, 8, 9 level, where at the 9th level there's a transformation of the body and mind where it becomes very, very blissful. You know, and your body feels very light. You feel like not touching the ground, you know, and the body is very, very supple, you know, and your mind is very, very sharp. You feel like you could count the atom in the world, you know, and then as a result of that, there's different types of clairvoyance that result. So you start remembering past life, you can intuit the mind of other, you know, so many kind of insight comes simply because your mind is subdued and stable. Right? So, you see, then whether you're Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, doesn't make any difference. Everybody gets these things. You know, it's simply the result of a tamed mind. You know? And then, of course, then, if you use that mind for any spiritual topic, the realization comes very fast. So it says, you see, 1 hour of meditation with calm abiding is like 100 years of meditation without it. You make the same progress in an hour than with calm abiding that the person, you know, would take 100 years to get that, simply because your mind is so focused. You know, so any topic you want to concentrate on, the insights come very quickly. So it's really something worthwhile to develop, to train in. You know, it has incredible benefit. So first of all, it's easy then, you see, because there's some kind of inner insatisfaction, we are overly attracted to sense pleasure, right? You know, because we don't feel so well, let's turn on the TV. You know, oh, let's go to watch a movie. You know, oh, you know, let's have that drink, let's have this and that. Why? Because there's something missing, right? So we feel this inner missing with all this sensory pleasure, and it gives us a momentary satisfaction. But once you have this inner satisfaction, you know, you look at that outer pleasure, oh, it's only that, boo, I have much better insight. You know, so you're not attracted so much to these things anymore, you know. So then non-attachment, you know, becomes very easy, right? And then bodhicitta, love and compassion, you know, you can focus on it, and then you can remain very stable in that for a very, very long time without being distracted, you know. And then ultimate reality, you know, you investigate phenomena, how they really exist, and you're able to stay there to the conclusion of your analysis, you know, you say, wow, that's how things exist. And you stay in that experience. You know, there's nothing to distract you. You're there and, wow, so beautiful. You know, and then you see, you get the insight, and you see all what it implies. You know, you see all the connection, all the interconnection of things. And then also, you get great control over your mind. You know, all the thoughts, all the negative emotion, you can stop at will, you know, because your mind has more power than the thought and emotion. So basically, if you don't want, you never get angry again, you know. You don't get obsessed about things, you know. You have complete control of that still mind. You know, you have complete control over your thoughts and emotion. So you can remain in a state of stillness all the time, and just use thoughts and emotion whenever you want. They are not overwhelming you, you know, like with the normal mind. No? So many beings, you know, in certain tradition, when they develop calm abiding. So once you have calm abiding, then you can go to more subtle states of absorption, you know, from the form absorption to the formless absorption, and higher into that state of inner bliss, inner space, you know, to the point that you don't have any more ordinary emotion or ordinary thought, and you actually, and you completely blissed out all the time, so you feel like you have reached liberation, you know, that you have reached moksha or liberation or enlightenment. So many people confuse these incredibly blissful experiences having reached the goal, right? Whereas in Buddhism one says, you see, that's just calm abiding, then you have to use that to understand how things actually exist. You need to develop special insight by focusing on how the self, me, body, mind, and other phenomena really exist. So, the greater you develop calm abiding, you know, the more peace you will experience, you know, the more happiness in your everyday life. And the easier you will make progress in the other, in your other meditation. And the less negative minds you will have, you know, the less disturbed, unsatisfied mind. So, for those reasons, it is very important to put a little bit of calm abiding meditation in your daily, you know, practice. It's very, you see, it has all these great benefits, even before you actually reach the goal of calm abiding, which for most of us might be difficult to reach because we have kind of busy life, you know. But usually it says, if one could go into retreat, you know, one could reach calm abiding within a year. You know, if you would do only that in a professional way, you know, you isolate yourself in a cabin, and you do that in a professional way, within a year it's reachable. You know? Yeah, so on the base of calm abiding, once you have reached calm abiding, then you start using thoughts again to analyze reality, right? And that, once you're able to keep calm abiding with using, because you see, at the beginning you're able to develop a calm, still mind when you don't use any thoughts, right? But then you, within that blissful state of calm abiding, you want to be able to use thoughts again, without losing that calm, blissful, still mind. You know, so it takes a few days from calm abiding to go to special insight. So when you're able to stay in this blissful state of meditative absorption and at the same time use thoughts to analyze reality, that's when you enter the second path. You know, the first is the path of accumulation, the second is the path of preparation. So you're able to analyze reality with a mind of calm abiding. So you understand reality, how things ultimately exist, but through the medium of using a thought process. So there's a gap between you and ultimate reality. That gap is your conceptual understanding of it. So that conceptual understanding, gradually the gap between you and how things actually exist, gradually diminish. And when you reach the path of seeing, they become one, you know. So when, on the path of seeing, when you see reality as it is, you become it. So there's not you meditating on emptiness, you become emptiness. So you utterly absorb into it. Right? And that's the end of your ordinary life. You know? From then on, you choose where you go, what you do. You're not anymore under the control of karma and mental affliction. Right? So we should all aim to reach that stage, at least in this life. You know? Because then on, you have done the good job. You know, my teacher, Geshe Tekchok, used to say, you know, once you have done that, you've done good job, then you can relax. You know. You know, because then you have complete control. You will never, you know, be reborn in an unfortunate situation. You will never have a messy life. You know, all this is finished. You have complete control. You know, control over your rebirth, you know, everything. You know, from then on, and also, you see, before that, before the middle of the path of preparation, your realization can decrease from lifetime. You see, you might reach a certain level in this life, but if you're not born in an appropriate place, you don't meet the teacher again, you might be completely, or suddenly you decide, you know, I want to become this and that. You know, you might be sidetracked in a life and not be interested by doing future spiritual development, then your realization would decrease, right? But you reach a stage in spiritual development where that mind never arise again, you never degenerate. So from then on, from lifetime to lifetime, you always make progress till you're full enlightened. So that's one thing, you know, if one can reach that stage, then, you know, one can relax. You know, now from now on it's good, you know. And like that. Yeah. And it's not that difficult, you see. It's like anything, there is a method, you know. And if you apply the method properly, we all are smart people, you know. No, we all manage to live a complicated Western 21st century life, you know. So meditation is much easier than our complex society, you know. So if we apply our mind, why shouldn't it work? You know. So it's just a matter, you know, how to say, each one of us, we are good at certain things. And how have we become good? Well, we had an interest in it, we trained in it, you know, had a sustained attention, that was our priority, and we got it, right? So it's the same thing with spiritual practice. It's just, you know, oh, I want that, and that's how to get it, let's do it. You know, so it's the same thing. But in order to work, one has, of course, you know, like you want to win the Olympics, you know, you want to swim and win the Olympics. Well, you know, you need to train 8, 9 hours a day, right? And then you have to give up a lot of distractions, you know. And then, you know, you can do it, right? So it's just a matter of, you know, sustained attention. So for spiritual realization, it's exactly the same thing, you know. So if you really want it and you go for it, you can get it. But if you only do it, you know, once a week, you know, or half hour a day, you know, then of course it's going to take a hell lot of time, you know. Like the guy that swims only half hour a day is never going to win the Olympics, you know, no matter how much he wants it, you know. So it's always dependent on how much, you know, we want it and how much we're able to sacrifice and dedicate for a certain goal. Then we can do it, you know. So each one of us, basically, we gain according to the amount of energy we put into it, right? And that's true for any field in our life. So same thing for spiritual practice and spiritual realization, you know? So first you have to learn the method, and then you see, well, that sounds, you know, that sounds something worthwhile to gain. And then you learn how to do it, and then you just go for it. You know, you create the good condition in your life for it, and you go for it. So it's feasible, you know. You know, the Buddha, you know, Milarepa, Lama Sangha, they were not smarter than us, you know. They were like us, you know. And in many ways, we have actually better condition than they had. You know, they lived in caves, you know, with the heat, the cold. They had bad food, you know. And they had animals bothering them and all the, you know, it was hard life, you know. We have much more comfort than they have. But they had this power of the mind, you know, they really wanted it. And they had very few distractions. So, you know. So, in a way, because our life is so comfortable, we have become weaker. Right? They had very little, so, the power of the mind was very strong, the sustained, you know, attention was very strong. They really wanted it. And of course, in those days, there was no Olympics and no World Cup and, you know, no these kind of things to distract them. Okay, so the first point is to see the benefit of having calm abiding, really to meditate on that fact. Wow, if I had calm abiding, I wouldn't have the distract mind, you know. I could control my emotion, I could control my thought, I could be the boss inside my head, instead of being constantly overwhelmed by anger, fear, jealousy, pride, you know, envy, and, you know, obsessed by this and that, you know, stream of thoughts. Right? And then, oh, I could experience inner bliss and inner happiness and joy, you know. I could experience this inner satisfaction. And then I could experience clairvoyance, you know. I could have intuition, you know, higher intuition, how things actually function, you know, better understand the people around me in my life, how to help them, you know. And then I could, whatever other meditation I do, I would make much quicker progress because I could stay in the mind of love, the mind of compassion, the mind of refuge. You know, any states of mind I want to cultivate, I could use a few thought to induce it and then stay in that experience instead of being constantly distracted, right? And then gradually, that control over your mind you can bring into you. You know, at the beginning you're able to do it on sitting on your cushion. But then gradually you can stand up, and walk out the door, and you're still in that state of mind, you know, amazing, you know. And then you go out the door, you know, you can walk down the street and still be in that state of mind, you know. And gradually you can even start talking and being in that state of mind, you know. So gradually you can extend that inner experience into more and more avenues of your life. You know, at the beginning it's mostly on the cushion, then, you know, you stand up and it's gone, you know. But gradually as you get control, you know, it pervades more and more dimensions of your life. Okay, so that's the first tool, the first realization for calm abiding is that, to think about the advantage. That by thinking about the advantage, it will make you look at your meditation cushion as something attractive, you know. Because before that, well, what shall I do? Shall I do a meditation session or shall I look baseball on TV? You know, which is more attractive, you know? So unless you think about the advantage of sitting on the cushion, the TV will be more attractive, you know. Less effort and instant satisfaction. You know, this one, you know, not sure, you know. Long, lot effort and not sure whether I get anywhere, you know. So by thinking about the advantage, that's the first things that will make you sit on the cushion, you know, and actually engage in the practice. So I'll just go over the outlines. I don't want to go into detail right now. Then the second point, you have to choose an object on which you will concentrate or focus on to develop calm abiding. And there are many types of object. So during the weekend we're going to explore a few of them because we all have different propensity, different faculty. For us, for some people it's easier to focus on the breath. For other people it's easier or they're more interested in focusing on the nature of the mind, the space-like nature of awareness. Other people it's easier to focus on a mental image, you know, like a Buddha or, you know, a flower or something. For other people, finally, it's easier to focus on a dot at the navel chakra and induce inner fire, you know. So for some people, that's easier. So what we're going to do during this weekend, we're going to do a few sessions where we try each one of those meditations. And then you will see the one you're more comfortable with, right? And then Sunday, we're going to do all, everybody would have chosen one object, and during the whole day we'll do sessions on just, you know, the one that you have chosen, so that you, because it's a question of developing familiarity with an object. You see, how to say, you cannot cross a river sitting on two boats at the same time, right? You have to choose one boat, you know. It leads you to the same thing, but somehow, you know, you need to choose one way. So same thing for calm abiding. At some point you have to choose one object, and in each session you go back to that object. And it's like making a groove, you know, it becomes deeper and deeper and deeper, right? Whereas if you each time, so for example, one of my teachers, Geshe Chodron Rinpoche, was saying, you know, because I have the tendency to use 2-3 objects, you know, I'm a naughty guy, you know, actually, you know, no. I'm Gemini, so Gemini, they like, you know, to go around, you know, trying different things. You know. So actually, I, you know, usually use 2-3, when I'm in retreat, I use 2-3 objects. I use a visualization space like nature of the mind, and what else? Emptiness, you know. So I have 3 objects usually I use. So I, you know, I reported to one of my teachers, you know, Chodron Rinpoche, you know. And he says, well, you know, it's like hitting 3 nails. You know, it's actually, you would go much faster if you only hit 1 nail. You might already have gotten it by now, you know. You hit on 3 nails, you know, so you make, you know, not so much progress, you know, not so quick progress, you know. So usually, you know, they advise you, at the beginning you try different objects and then you choose one and then you go down that groove, you know, which makes sense, right? So then you have to choose an object, and then you have to make your session, you see. So the first power of mind that you develop is the power of determination. You see, so there's certain mental strength or certain mental force that you develop and that you cultivate. So first is determination. You see, the determination will say, you know, so you start, you sit down and say, you know, now for 10 minutes, I'm not going to move away from the tip of my nose. I will put my attention to the tip of my nose, and for 10 minutes, I'm not going to move away from that. So that's the power of determination. You see, we use that, let's say you don't have an alarm clock and you have a plane to take at 4 o'clock next morning. You know, I have to wake up at 3 o'clock. You know, so you put a determination there. I have to do that. And somehow, surprisingly, at 3 o'clock you wake up. Right? So there's a kind of inner energy, the power of determination, right? So, or you say, or let's say, you know, you go to work and you think, oh, you know, I have to buy milk tonight before going home. Right? So you go to work and you don't think about the milk at all the whole day. But when you come out of work, suddenly you, boom, light goes on, milk, you know, the thought comes and there you go, you know, you buy your milk, you know. So that's the power of determination, you know. You can create a thought for something you want to do, and then somehow that's an energy that brings that about, right? So for calm abiding, that you put the structure into place. Now for 10 minutes, I'm going to focus on the tip of my nose, you know, if that's your object, for example. You know. So now for 10 minutes, I'm going to, no matter what else happens, that's not the time. I can think about it after the 10 minutes. But now for 10 minutes, that's what I'm going to do. Right? So that's, you know, for example, this Zen saying, you know, or even if the Buddha appear, you know, you wouldn't pay any attention, you know. You know, even the Buddha, you know, because now I'm focusing on Ben, you know, Buddha, please wait 10 minutes, you know, now I'm busy, you know, kind of like that. So it's in the context of developing calm abiding, right? So you focus, so it's the power of determination now for 10 minutes, I'm going to do that, okay? Then the next strength of mind you develop is the power of mindfulness. So here, the power of mindfulness is not the power of mindfulness like we usually understand it. It's not mindfulness on a changing object, constantly changing. You know, like in ordinary mindfulness, you simply are in the present moment and you are aware of any sensation in your body, any thought. You know, the objects constantly change. You have the sustained attention of a changing object. Here, the mindfulness is a mindfulness of not forgetting the object of attention. Right? So, you see, you try to develop a sustained attention. So you put your attention on the tip of your nose, and then you try not to let go of the tip of your nose. You know? So that your mind doesn't move away from the tip of your nose. So that's sustained attention. You don't let it go. You know, like, you know, when you give a bone to a dog, no matter how much you try to take it away, you know, no way, you know. He has developed sustained attention on his bone. So same thing, you see, you put your attention on the tip of your nose, and no matter what thought arise, you know, no matter how, you know, thoughts or different mental phenomena try to pull you away from it, at least with one part of the mind, you're not let go. Right? So that's, and then that becomes easier and easier. At the beginning you need kind of a lot of sustain that, you know, a lot of strength, you know, in order not to let go. Right? And then, as you become, as you become better at it, you can actually relax the grip of your attention, you still don't lose it. Right? And you can reach a point where actually you can effortlessly stay in that sustained state of attention. Right? So that's the goal. So first, there's the determination, I'm going to do that, you know, for 10 minutes. Then the second is the mindfulness of not forgetting the object during the whole duration. And then the third power or the third strength of mind you develop is introspection or vigilance. So that is, you see, you put your attention on the tip of your nose with mindfulness and you don't let it go. And then with the corner of your mind, from time to time, you look how you're doing, how you fare. See, whether distraction is arising, whether you have forgotten the object, or whether your dullness has arisen. So, it's a corner of your mind observes how your meditation, how you're doing. You know, there's a policeman that you put there. You know, check how you're driving, you know. So you have your inner policeman that checks how your meditation is going. Right? So that's the third strength of mind you develop. And then the fourth one is the applying the antidote. So that once you have looked with vigilance or introspection, you have seen that your mind is distracted, is agitated. So you have to release the grip. You see, you know, when you try to tune a guitar, right? So the string are either too tight or too loose, right? So to have the right tune, you have to the right pitch, you know, you have to. So you go up and down, till you find the middle, the right middle. Right? So with your attention, with your mindfulness, it's the same thing. You see, calm abiding is sustained attention like that, you know? But when we hold with mindfulness the object, either we hold the object too tight or too loose. Too tight, too loose. So too tight brings excitement, brings about thoughts. And too loose brings about dullness, sleepiness, right? So you have to find how much you need to hold, how tight you need to hold the object, right? And when you reach the right pitch, the mind becomes very flat. You know, there's no more subtle subliminal thoughts and no more subtle dullness. You know, the mind is clean, clear. You know? So that's by applying the antidote, by realizing that the mind is either too tight or too loose, you correct it till you have the right pitch. You know? And then the last power is non-application. So first was application and then non-application. You see, you reach a point where by developing mindfulness with the help of introspection, you apply the antidote to distraction and dullness, right? So you constantly watch the main part of your mind meditating, and when the mind is too tight, you loose up. And when it becomes too loose, you tight up. You know, you tighten, you loosen, you tighten, you loosen. But you reach a point where actually most of the time your mind is exactly perfect. The guitar is totally... You see, once the guitar is finely tuned, if you keep on, you know, changing it, then it becomes an obstacle, right? You needed to do it to fine-tune it, but once it's fine-tuned, you stop it, right? So it's the same thing there, you know? So first you fine-tune by applying the antidote, but you can get addicted, you can become a control freak, you know? You want always to control and change, you know? So at that point, when it's finely tuned, you need to stop, you know, applying the antidote, adjusting, yes. Yeah. So these are the five strengths of mind that you develop during the process of developing calm abiding. You know? So these are the five tools, the five strengths of mind that you gradually develop, the skills, you know, you use in your mind. And through these skills, you go from level zero, you know, the starting point. Actually, some people, you will see, you know, some people start at level zero, some people start at level one, some people start at level two, some people start at level three, and some even start at level four. Because due to our lifestyle, due to our profession, due to sport, some people might already have developed the skill of mind to a certain degree, you know. And usually I have led two weeks retreat of calm abiding in California. And during the 2 weeks, most people would make progress of two stages. If they start at level one, after 2 weeks they would be at level three. Those that start at level three would be at level five, you know, within 2 weeks. So you see, it's actually feasible, you know, you know. But you have to put so of course it was in a retreat situation. You know, people would meditate from 7 in the morning till 9 at night. Of course, so it was 7 to 8 and 1.5 hour breakfast, you know, and then from 9:30 to 12, then from 3 to 6, and then from 7 to 9, you know. So with that schedule, you know, within 2 weeks people made two stages of progress, you know. And some got to level six, you know. So two students thought they had reached level six. So they had only 3 to go. But they are, you know, they're harder up there, you know. There was a lot of inquiry, you know, because at the beginning you do this routine, you say, it's not possible, no, I cannot do it. And then you put yourself in the condition of a retreat, and you actually see that the progress you make, and say, oh wow. So half the students thought they could achieve calm abiding within this life. You know, they have reached that self-confidence due to the progress they made. They say, oh yes, if I put my attention to it, I could get it. You know, so I think that's a great encouragement when you learn something and you make a certain progress. You say, "Oh wow, you know, that's something I could do if I put my attention to it." Right? And what's beautiful, there's a method. You see that you're going to learn. So once you know the trick, You know, it's like the same thing, you know, if you want to make a rabbit go out of a hat, you know, if you don't know the trick, it's hard, right? But if you know the trick, it's, you know, it's not that hard, you know. So you just have to learn the trick. So that's the beauty with the meditation, is that in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a method, you know, that you learn. So you learn the trick and then you can do, you know, you're in charge. Mm. Okay, so 8 o'clock, maybe we make a 5 minutes break, pee-pee break. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the first meditation, so we're going to do a number of 5 minutes meditation. So one that is important, especially for us Westerners, is to scan the body. You see, many of us, we are quite disconnected, we live quite in the head, and we are not paying much attention of how we sit. So, if you don't sit properly, and if there's tension in your, you know, in your shoulder or in your back, and then you sit for 10 minutes, that tension, you know, accumulates, and that tension in the body then creates tension in the mind. Right? So the body affects the mind and the mind affects the body. So you have to find a position that is comfortable for you. Each one of us has a different back, a different, you know, suppleness in the knees. So you have to find a position that's comfortable you, that you can sit for half hour without, you know, creating first injuries, you know, because many people get injuries in the knee, you know, they put themselves into a sitting position that's painful, and they think they can overpass their pain, you know, by focusing on, but it's not true, you know, it just becomes worse, worse and worse. And like me, you need to have the meniscus fixed, you know? You know? Because you push, you push, you push, and then, you know, something happens. So, you know, one has to sit comfortably. Find a position that works for you. So usually the way to do that is that you sit down and then you move a little bit your body around, you know, so that, you know, till you, you know, you remove the stiffness like that. And then, so that's the gross level. Then the subtle level, you see, we don't notice how much the eyes are tense. You know, behind the eyes there are muscles that make you look around, you know, these muscles tense. And then the jaw, you know, here, often there's tension, you know. We have, and I don't know, it says when you smile, how many muscles are moving. And when you're upset, you know, how many muscles, you know. So there's a lot of muscle being tense just to have a normal face, right? That. So you relax the face, you know. then often we are tense in the shoulder because we're in front of a computer or we drive, you know. So you move a little bit the shoulder, you know, and you try to relax that. And then you go down your spine, you know, often to keep you straight. You see, none of us have a perfect, you know, spine. We're all a little bit crooked. And to maintain a position, you know, some muscle adjustment need to work there, you know. So you try to see that and find a position, a sitting position that, you know, the minimum muscles are involved for you to keep you straight, you know. And then you check your hips. You know, often there's also tension in the hips. And then you go down to the knees, you relax the knees. And then the finger joint and the toes joint, you know. So like that you scan your body from head to toe and from toe to head, you know, for 5 minutes. And you try to understand how your body sits, you see. And then as you meditate, even when you do other meditation, from time to time you go back and you check how your body is doing. You see, if you sit comfortably in a position that is well for you without any tension, you know, at the level of muscles and joint, you suddenly realize that you could sit much longer than you thought. Before you thought, you know, 20 minutes is your maximum, and suddenly you realize you can actually sit for 40 minutes or an hour, you know, simply by looking how your body is sitting and adjusting, you know. And that also allows you to learn to know your body, you know. And then you might find some heaviness in your liver or your kidney, you know. So you put some light and some space there, you know. Or if you have pain somewhere, you put your mind there. Again, you put some light and some space. So you see, you learn to know your body, you learn to relax your body and to sit comfortably, so that after you can put your attention on the object of meditation with the optimum body, you know, sitting position. So we do that for 5 minutes. So relax. Move your body around a bit. So now for the position for karma biting. There are certain things that help. So whether one sits cross-legged or sits on a chair, it's good if your back allows you not to rest against the back. You know, so if you sit on a chair, you try to raise the back, you know, the backbone, you know, the back, so that you can actually sit straight, you know, without leaning against too much, you know. So if you sit straight and you just lean a little bit, that's okay. But if you actually, you know, have to be like that, so then it becomes more difficult to control your mind. You know, sleepiness and distracting thoughts are, you know, stronger, and also you won't be able to sit very long in that posture. So usually, when I sit on a chair, I put a blanket on the back just to raise the backbone, and then I can actually sit, you know, on a chair. So usually in retreats, I have a cushion like that on the floor, and then I have a chair next to it, and I do some session on the chair and some session on the floor. You know, because after a while, you know, the chair is uncomfortable, so I sit on the floor, and after a while, the floor becomes uncomfortable, I go on the chair, kind of like that. But it really helps to have the back straight, unless one has back problem, you know. Then it's also possible actually to meditate lying down. So the supine position is also a meditative posture. So if one has pain in the back, you know, or sometimes has pain in the back, one can actually lay down. You know, on the floor. Beds usually are too soft, you know, one has the memory of sleeping, so, you know, it's kind of easy to fall asleep. So, that's for the leg, the back, and then for the hands, so that's the position, you know, sitting like a mountain, you know, so it's like a very stable position, whether we are, you know, sitting cross-legged or sitting on a chair. Also put the hands on the, you know, on the legs like that. Or the other position, so is to put one palm in the other one, you know, with the two thumbs touching. You know, that also, that's like a rock, you feel stable, and that can align your energy, you know, into the central channel. You know, kind of like that. So it's good to start your sitting session in one of these two postures, but then as the session unfolds, if your hand naturally want to take another position, it's fine. You know, once you're in the meditative state, you kind of forget a little bit the body, but you start with the best position possible. That helps you to go into a state of meditation. And then once you're in a state of meditation, the body becomes less important, you know. So you can take whatever position you know, you naturally go for. But it's good to start like that. Like that. And then the elbow is good to have them a little bit apart from the body, not against the body like that, because somehow to have some air flowing through under the arm, you know, it helps your mind to stay, you know, to go into meditation. Like that somehow, it also constricts your mind, you know, so. And also, probably, when it's hot, you know, you might, you know, have more perspiration. So like that. And then, you try to have, you know, you feel like somebody's pulling you, you know, up here. You know, so you feel like there's something, you know, pulling you up here. And you feel that your spine goes into the earth. You know, that you have some roots going down. You know, so that your body is really aligned like that. You know, kind of like that. Of course, your spine makes an S, right? But you have that feeling that here it goes up and that you've gone down into the center of the earth. So it's a very stable position. And then your tongue is against the upper palate behind your front teeth. that prevents saliva from arising. And then, you know, otherwise you get distracted having to swallow the saliva. And your mouth is closed, your lips are together closed, but your teeth are not touching each other. You know, the upper, there's a gap in your mouth between the upper and lower teeth. And then, for the eyes, usually it says at the beginning it's better to have the eyes slightly open, you know, and to gaze in space in front of you. This prevents sleepiness from arising. So it's good to start like that, but then if your eyes naturally close, and for you it's easy to meditate like that, it's fine. Usually when you meditate a lot, sometimes you have the eyes slightly open, sometimes they are closed. And after a while it doesn't make any more difference, because you focus on the mental consciousness. So you reach a point, there's no more difference between the eye open and closed. Because your energy has withdrawn from the sight consciousness, you absorb into mental consciousness. Same thing at the beginning when you meditate, you get distracted by sounds, right? So it's important to avoid meditating when there's annoying sounds going around, you know. So it's to use the time of the day where there's least distraction. However, once your concentration has developed, again your consciousness is withdrawn from the ear consciousness. So the sounds appear very far to you. So you don't get distracted anymore by sounds. But at the beginning, it's important to take care of that. So it's good when you sit down to do a karma binding session. You go to these points, you check your leg, how you sit. Then you check your hand, how you posture them, you elbow, that your shoulders are straight, that without any tension, that you have this feeling that you really rooted into the ground, and that the top of your head goes up, you know? And then that your tongue is against the upper palate, your mouth is closed, and that you gaze in front of you, you know, with the eyes half closed. So it's just to let some light in. You know, it prevents from dozing off. Actually, often when you look at the Buddha statues, you know, the Buddha often has that posture of the eyes slightly open and gazing in front like that. And once your posture is settled, then what you do, you try to take care of your mind. And take care of your mind means you exhale, you imagine that you exhale the thoughts that you have. You see, you might have been busy doing this and that. So the Dalai Lama advises to take 3 deep breaths, you know. So you inhale here, and you focus on the exhale, and you imagine that you exhale your emotion, you exhale your thoughts, to bring your mind to a neutral state. So we can do that, take 3 deep breaths and exhale. Then from that neutral state of mind, we try to take refuge. You know, we try to open our heart to our spiritual teacher or to the Buddhas or to enlightened beings or the spirit of goodness and ask, you know, to get blessing from them, you know, that they look at us with love and compassion, that they help us in our meditation. Then we try to remind ourselves we are not only meditating for ourselves. We remember, put that mind into the thought, you know, I'm meditating also to become a better person for my partner, children, parents, friends. And ultimately, I wish to be able to help all beings if I can. Then you make the determination, for 5 minutes, I'm not going to let go of my mind focusing on the breath. So you can decide either to focus just at the nostril or the whole movement of the breath, the whole inhale or exhale. So you see that and you say, now for 5 minutes, I'm going, at least with one part of my mind, I'm not going to let go. And if my mind wanders off, as soon as I become aware of it, I simply bring it back. So you try to develop a mindfulness of not forgetting the object with at least one part of your mind for 5 minutes. So as you continue focusing on the breath, try to make your attention more tight and more loose. Try to see what happens to your mind when you tighten up your attention and when you loose. And by going to the extreme of tightening and loosening, you find the middle way. You find how to sustain your attention with the least effort, yet without forgetting it. So one thing that one learns is that when you enter meditation, you enter gently. You know, you take care of your position, and then you exhale the stale air, you put up your motivation, and so now the determination, and you go on to your object, okay? So now when you end the meditation in the same way, you know, you hear the bell, you know, you know, so... So you lose the space, right? So, whereas if you, you know, you focus on the, and you move very gently out. You know, you open the eyes very gently, and very gently you move the body. So something of that sustained attention then is kept, you know, and starts pervading your other activities. Alright, so, I thought we'd do some question-answer. So you have an idea of what we're going to do these next 2 days. We're going to train in that. And on top of the breath, we're going to train how to observe the mind, take the mind as an object. You know, so we'll have training two objects during this weekend, the breath and the mind. Because for some people, one is easier than the other. Okay? So if you have any questions, you're most welcome. Yes.
I had a teacher tell me to, I have had a teacher direct me to, when I sit and my leg falls asleep after 25, 30 minutes.
What falls asleep?
Just my leg. My leg falls asleep.
Yeah.
And he says, just let it sleep. And it'll wake up after you get up again, but it does get very uncomfortable, and I tend to switch sides after.
It's that. Better, because you can pinch a nerve, and it can come quite bad to the point you cannot actually move anymore, you know. So depending what you do, you know, it's actually better to move. You know, if it's a little bit, it's okay, but if it becomes really uncomfortable, it's better to move.
Thank you, Keshava.
Yeah. So, so you can, like, you know, if you can, you know, move a little bit and stay in the meditative state, that's fine. But if you need to take a break, you know, sit on a chair, and, you know, what you do, whatever you need to do to keep, you know, body well. Yeah.
There is a book by Alan Wallace, I believe, where they described a combating retreat they did in Washington State some years ago. And in that, his teacher, Jindal Rinpa, says, when you begin the meditation to draw the mind inside, could you talk a little bit about how to do that?
Well, you know, observing your body, you know, it draws the mind inside, right? And then you bring your attention on the breath or the mind. So the mind is quite scattered and gradually will go inside more and more and more. So it's a gradual process. You know, it happens naturally. So a mind of calm abiding is actually, you're so focused on the mental consciousness that the sense consciousness will appear very far. You know, the mind is so withdrawn inside that actually the sight, even though you have the eye open, you are not actually aware of what you see. Even though your ears are not blocked, you don't hear anything. You know, because you're so focused on the mind, the sensory consciousness, you know, cease functioning, so to say. But it's a gradual process. Yeah.
I wonder what advice you would give to someone that as they're trying to sustain their focus, sustain their attention on the object, they find that their mind, as in Zen, the monkey mind, right?
It's
just,
yes.
It's just going everywhere.
Yes.
And it's so easy to get frustrated.
Yes.
And then you think, oh, this isn't working.
Yes.
And then you quit.
Yes.
You stop. I was wondering what advice you would give to help someone to not give up.
So there's different types of breathing. So one is the 9-round breathing. You might have heard or practiced even, you know, some of you. So because in Tantra, so the 9-round breathing comes from Tantra. And it says that the scattered mind comes when the wind are mostly flowing into the right channel, and that the angry, irritated mind comes when the mind is mostly flowing in the left channel, and that the peaceful, settled mind is when the wind flows in the central channel. So you try to do this breathing where you exhale, instead of, like the Dalai Lama explained, just inhaling once and exhaling, you know, three times deeply. The 9-round breathing is a little bit more complex. So you inhale three times right and exhale three times left. And you do that, you know, circle. So it makes 9, right? And you repeat that 3 times or even more, you know, till your mind is settled. So you can help. So one way of doing it is just visualization way. And then there's a more complex way where you do it. You might have, you know, kind of like that. So, and that would help, you know. So that's one technique. You can do that for a while. There's another thing that helps. You inhale and you hold the breath. You stop breathing, basically. You inhale and you hold the breath. And in that space between two breaths, actually there's a gap. And so you can get into a gap between thoughts, you know, and try to rest there. So these are two methods. And then the third thing to advise is to make a very short session. You know, maybe you start with 2 minutes or 3 minute session, you know. And then it's good to have something like, you know, have some stocks in Apple and Android, you know, so some application, you know, where you dial the amount of time and it does the gong by itself. So basically you don't need to put a watch in front of you and always open the, how many minutes left, you know, how many seconds left, or 10 seconds, 9 seconds, 8 seconds. So, you know, he's doing his job, you know. I'm joking. Yeah. So yeah, one has to start with very short session, but often, you know. And you will see actually, you know, first of all, different parts of the day, are easier. Some people are morning person. The mind is clear in the morning. And some people, oddly, after midnight, it starts working well. You know? So we all have a different biorhythm. So you have to see, you know, what works. You have to try different periods of the day, you know, different time, you know, and find when it works for you. You know, we're all different. So it's by trying, and also different location, different direction. Somehow, you know, I had one teacher, Geshe Tekchoki, which was traveling a lot. And when he would be invited to stay a few weeks or months, you know, to teach in a place. So the first few days you would go to visit him, he would always sit in a different place in the house, you know. And he would change the orientation, you know. And when he had found his spot, then for the rest of you would always see him there. You know, he had found his spot where he was happy. You know, so, you know, that work. So for us, it's the same. You have to find your spot, you know, in your house. You have to arrange, you know, and then suddenly you find, oh, here's nice, you know. And then you found your spot. And then you always meditate on that space because actually certain energy accumulates there, right? So how to say, yeah. So if you keep on moving where you meditate, somehow that energy doesn't accumulate. So, whereas if you always sit and you only do meditation there, so you don't use that seat for other stuff, yeah, that's the place where you meditate, you know. So usually when one does retreat, you see if one does group retreat like that, so the place where you sit, even other people are not allowed to walk over, because it changes the energy. That's your energy space, and you know, and you accumulate that energy there, right? So, you know, of course, in certain flats, you know, people have very short, actually that's more in Europe, or New York, you know, very short place, you know. So it's not really possible, you know, otherwise you end up in the cupboard or... But here, you know, people tend to have more space, so you can actually create your little space, you know, where you meditate. And definitely it helps, you know, if you only keep that space, you make it... You know, your precious little meditation spot, then it really helps. And then also, so trying different objects. You will see during the weekend, some, like the breath, for some people is difficult. Yet focusing on third eye, or focusing on the navel chakra, or focusing on the nature of the mind, suddenly it becomes possible. You know, so we'll try, you know, different things. And, you know, maybe you could speak with the teacher, you know, on one-to-one, try different things. And it's like, you know, normally it should work. We'll find a way. Yes. Yes.
Just on the topic of exploring different avenues towards concentration, is repetition of a mantra, is that considered a form of like a mental repetition of a mantra in the mind, a form of a concentration meditation, or would that not be considered in the same category? Or is that even not even a meditation?
So in a certain way, it helps to slow down the mind, you know, the sound. But it says to develop calm abiding, you have to use a mental object, so not a sound, right? So the sound of the mantra, you couldn't use a mantra to develop calm abiding, right? But you can use the mantra to still your mind. Because when you recite mantra, what you do, basically you don't hear the other thoughts. Right? You might have thoughts, so you make more noise with the mantra than the other noise of the thoughts, right? So you block them off, right? So, and then you don't pay attention to them, so their strength comes because you pay attention and you feed them, right? So because you don't hear them so much, you don't feed them, so they slow down, right? So it helps to calm the mind, right? But the mantra itself is not, you cannot get calm abiding focus on the mantra, but you can focus on a visualization. You see, for example, a mantra is associated with a specific deity, right? So you could visualize that deity in front of you, or if you have the initiation, you could visualize yourself as that deity, And that would be an acceptable and a good object of developing calm abiding. Then you could use the mantra to still your mind, and then once that gross agitation is gone, then you stop reciting the mantra and you stay with the visualization of the deity. And that would be an object of calm abiding. Okay?
You talked about the eye position being half closed.
Mm.
But I find myself and focused in front, and I find that distracting. Is there, because then I'll say, oh, like this
yes,
in
yes,
front of
yes.
me, oh, she has a yellow shirt.
Exactly.
You
exactly.
Know? And then, I like that shirt.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, a thought elaboration happens, you know, conceptual elaboration. Yes, yes. So, you see, when you have the eye open, normally your gaze is in space. You're not looking at what's at the other side. You just look, you focus, you know, like a camera, you have the, you know, you can focus the objective, you know. So basically, you know, you have the eye open, but you don't see what's there. You focus in, you know, your focus is here. So even though there's something there, your focus is here. Right? But that takes time. You know, so at the beginning, that's the problem. We get distracted by what's in front. So then it's better to close, because otherwise you start thinking about, oh, you know, nice carpet, you know. Where did they bought that? You know, I want to have one. You know, you know, whereas after a while, basically, you can have the eye, it's open, and you don't see the carpet. You know, like that. And actually, when we use the space like nature of the mind, there's different ways of doing it, and some are with focusing on space. So you will see that tomorrow, you know. Yeah.
I don't like this mic thing. I feel like Phil Donahue. Like two. There is something you mentioned, and with all of my I've been meditating for, well, almost a decade now, and I've never heard, I've heard my teacher say, you know, mind opens up, you see things more clearly, you gain focus, clarity, and clarity, okay? Mm-hmm. So when you're mentioning the, you mentioned the word clairvoyancy, you mentioned the word intuitive, you mentioned the word, you know, just basic insight mm-hmm. into the mind, where you're able to actually see how mm-hmm. where I'm at is, and I really try and maintain, I know how my body's going to react if I do this.
Mm-hmm.
I know how this person is going to treat me if I go there, and mm-hmm. I don't want to go into mm-hmm. a war zone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, just even though, you know, just like my son's a Marine, he doesn't want to go into the war zone
right.
unless he has to.
Right.
So, and then it's a has to thing.
Yes.
Not because it's something, as you mentioned as well, that you become more aware and you're not creating these stories in your mind mm-hmm. and become part of a play that you're not meant to be a part of.
Right.
So can you get into more of the clairvoyancy part, where as the mind sharpens and the I call it my mind's eye opens up.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to hear your take on. I'm trying to find the right words. Where you would say gains more deeper insight in when you mention the nine stages, because I never heard it phrased that way before. I've heard other of my friends that are intuitives like myself, you know, mention that as their mind opens up, as they see things more clearly, they're more centered, they're more focused, they actually live in that space where they can see it without being part of it.
Yeah, well.
Am I kind of making sense?
Well, look, I answer based on what I understand from your question. It might be, you know, touching something you talk about, and maybe not. I try, okay? So, you see, what happens is that an agitated mind is a fragmented mind. It's like when you have a wind, you know, you have a pond, you know, and there's wind, so there's ripples at the surface because of the wind, right? And then what that fragmented surface of the water does, it reflects the trees and the clouds, you know, in this fragmented way. You don't have a clear picture. Or if it is full moon, you know, you don't see the full moon. The moon is, you know, kind of, you know, fragmented. Whereas if there's no wind and there's no water running, the water becomes completely clear and still, right? And then it reflects very clearly the trees, the stars, the moon. You know, it becomes very, very clean, very clear, right? So a mind that is still, you know, has that quality of, you know, you have a question and you stay with that question, and in that silence, somehow your own intuition, your own Buddha nature revealed, gives you insight, right? Kind of. But how much you can trust it, it has many, many layers of, you know. So, how to say, when I was a teenager, I used to have friends that follow their intuition, you know, their insight, and they go from one messy situation to another messy situation, right? So intuition doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that it's clean, you know, it can be quite, you know. So basically, the heart and the head have to be in harmony. It has to make sense to you, you know, to your mind, you know, So you have to keep your intuition in check, you know. So you have to check whether they make sense or not. And as your mind become cleaner and cleaner, they become more and more accurate, you know. But you have to, you know, you have to check, you know, kind of like that. So same thing people which make divination. You know, it's easy to make any divination. Everybody can flip a coin and say, you know, head is yes and tail is no, right? Everybody can flip a coin, you know. And make divination. You know, I can open a shop, you know, and say, look, come see me, I make divination, you know, and I flip a coin. Yes, dear, yeah, you should do it. No, you shouldn't do it, you know. Like, you know? But whether it's accurate or not, you know, is another question, right? So it's same thing, you know. So same thing, you know, people which make divination, depends the purity of their mind. You know, then the divination, sometimes it starts with being 50% accurate, and then it's 60%, then 70%, 80%, then the highly realized being, you know, have maybe a 99% of accuracy, right? But that's through, you know, experimenting, you know, and gradually you see how reliable they are. Okay.
When I meditate, I like to meditate on, for instance, visualizing the Buddha.
Yes.
So, would you suggest that's a good thing? Well, obviously it's a good thing. Or changing from Buddha to Tathā, or just keep to the one and not very elaborate, for instance, because Tathā is so elaborately, you know, so ornate. Do you really need to look at every single bit of her? I find that kind of distracting. What would your advice be, please? Thank you.
So normally, when one meditates, you see sometimes on like Tara Puja, then like Shakyamuni and things like that. So in everyday meditation, there's many objects of meditation, right? But when you want to go developing calm abiding, at some point you have to choose one, and in each session of calm abiding you would always take the same object. Otherwise you hit 2-3 nails at the same time. Okay? That. So now that each object has its advantage and its shortcoming. Okay? So the advantage of the breath is that everybody breathes and nobody has a question to where is the breath. You know, everybody knows, you know, where the object is and can find it. You know, the problem with the visualization of Shakyamuni Buddha or Tara or any visualization, some people, what you talk about, I cannot see anything. You know, they cannot, the faculty of visualization is not their forte, you know. So certain lamas say, well, everybody can visualize, everybody can remember their mother. You know, but so how does it come that we can remember our mother and not a Buddha? It's simply we have seen our mother for 10 years, you know, so we have this memory of that image for so long that it's easy to generate. Whereas the Buddha, well, we have seen a few times a picture, you know, so we don't have a great acquaintance with that image, right? So it's more difficult to generate, right? But for some people, even remembering their mom or the image of their kids is difficult. You know, the faculty of visualization, of imagination is not very developed, you know. So for those, it may be better to take another object. So now the advantage, if one can visualize and takes the Buddha as an object, is that it's a virtuous object, it's a wholesome object. So you see, if you meditate an hour of focusing on the Buddha, all that time you put positive imprint in your mind. Whereas if you use the breath, it's a neutral object. So its power comes from your motivation before, but the object itself is neutral. It doesn't have any special quality to focus on the breath. Whereas if you focus on the Buddha, all these hours that you focus on the Buddha puts a very strong imprint in your mind. Then, if at the time of death, you can, it would be easy to remember Buddha as you die. And then if you remember Buddha as you die, even though you have created the karma to be reborn in a negative place, in a painful place, that memory of the Buddha is so virtuous that it prevents that negative karma from ripening and you end up in a good place. Right? So that's the advantage of using a Buddha image as an object of calm abiding. Okay? And then if one uses, for example, the nature of the mind, you see, the nature of mind is a space of awareness. It has no form, no shape, no color, it doesn't abide anywhere. It's just space that cognizes. And that space is very close to how the ultimate nature of phenomena. So if you use the space of awareness as an object of calm abiding, then it's easy to realize emptiness. Right? Because it's very close. In terms of appearance, it's the same. It's just the space of awareness is a positive phenomena, and emptiness is a non-affirming negation, is a non-finding of something. But in terms of appearing, it's the same, it's just space. So if you focus on space, then it's easy to understand the ultimate nature of the mind. Okay, so you see each one has its advantage and its shortcoming. That's why we're going to try different. And we're all different. You will see if we try different objects and do you ask which one you prefer, you will see actually one-third prefer the breath, one-third prefer the visualization, one-third prefer the nature of the mind. No, so that's why it's good to try different things and to know that it's not that one is better than another. We just are different, and then some are easier than other. Okay.
We're running a bit late, so yeah. This we'll need to wrap up with this being the last question.
Yeah.
I was just wondering because when and I heard it before the analogy of fine tuning, tuning. If it's too tight, loosen it too. Okay, so when we're tuning an instrument, sometimes we'll use a note too.
Yes.
Okay, so my question is, are we, is it a certain frequency that we're trying to abide on and like the alpha or something? And also, the chants. So some of the chants bring you to that level and that's the calming effect. I was kind of wondering about that.
I think in everyday life, you are sometimes in a state of calm abiding for a few fraction of second, but you don't recognize. You know, or sometimes a minute, or, you know. So in daily life, we are sometimes in a state of concentration, but we don't, you know, we're not aware of it because we don't look at the mind in this way. You know, we use the mind, you know, so we are not watching the mind that is aware of this and that. So for example, you watch at a painting, you know, there's a state of stillness, a state of gazing and there's a silence there, staring, which is actually could be calm abiding, it could be the right pitch, right? But you don't want to do that for an hour, you know, or, you know, you don't want to develop calm abiding on that, right? So we have it, but we don't recognize, okay? So there is a way of looking at the mind that you try to bring it about at will and then to cultivate it. No, like that. I don't remember the second part of your question.
Well, the second part of the question was because somewhere I read or heard as far as the early morning hours that our minds are pretty much in an alpha state.
Mm-hmm.
And so it hasn't gotten riled up or anything yet,
yeah.
And it's a good time to. And so I wondered about this state and trying to figure out how to keep this state, which you pretty much
yeah.
said. But I wondered if that was like trying to remain in the alpha in a certain frequency.
Yeah.
And if the chants, some of the chants would have you, if you're too high, too low, it has a calming effect. And
yeah.
I wondered if we're just tuning it to a certain frequency that way.
I'm not sure. I would say no. I would tend to say no. You know, it's not like it's a certain frequency that you know, there's higher or lower. It's more level of sustained attention. And it's true, it's easier to meditate in the morning for most people because they haven't yet, you know, all the agitation of the day. You know, actually they come out of sleep, which is usually, you know, not much happening. You know, so you come out of that, so your mind is not yet completely awake or completely involved into thinking, and you don't have yet sensory experience, right? So it's, for most people, this is the easiest morning early to meditate, but not everyone. You know, the Italians or the Spanish people, they cannot meditate in the morning. You know, you know, I led a retreat, you know, everybody was there at 7 o'clock, you know, and my Mexican friend, you know, she told me, you know, do I have the permission not to come? Because I come and I fall asleep, you know. Myself, usually I wake up at 10 o'clock, you know. So for that person, morning, it didn't work. But, you know, the rest of the day, if she could sleep till 9 o'clock and come at the 10 o'clock, she would do perfectly well and make great progress, you know. And she could meditate late into the night, you know. So different people, you know, kind of like that. Okay, we shall stop here. So we dedicate, you know, whatever positive energy we have generated by coming here, making the effort of coming here and trying to listen to what was said and think about it and meditate. So may this ripen into our being able one day to develop calm abiding and with all the quality that that state of mind brings. And from there, you know, with that calm mind, develop bodhicitta and the realization of how things ultimately exist, and thereby become a bodhisattva and gradually go to the stage of path and become a fully enlightened being, discover our own pure Buddha nature.
Maybe we can change.
Yes.
Will you do Gewa in Tibetan or in English?
In Tibetan.
Okay. Thank you for your attention. Good night. Oh, please.
Okay. We have an anonymous sponsor, and the person's dedication. May our teachers, Kyabje Lama Zompa Rinpoche, Kyabje Chodo Rinpoche, Geshe Gyalak, and Venerable Rume live long and happy lives, and may they continue to guide us in this life and all our future lives. May all their aspirations and projects come to fruition quickly and effortlessly. And may we gain realizations in their teachings and our Buddha nature be revealed to us in this lifetime. And Louise Miller, dedicated to His Holiness's visit to North Carolina and the health of Lama Zompa Rinpoche. Do we have time for the prayer list? Or? Okay. Prayers for happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters. All the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. John Ahern, Alexa Alston, Julio Castro, Benjamin Courtney, Kathy Fortner, Virginia Lytle, Charles Renard, Theodore Henry Schreppel, David Allen Swanger, Brianna Yontz, Luna Bell the Rat, Job Search, John Powell, Justin Kelly, prayers for health and well-being, Captain Lama Zompa Rinpoche, Venerable Margaret McAndrew, Venerable Chirkila, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters, for the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom, Jim Barnes, Malika Bility, Yukiko Burrows, Dimitri Diamandopoulos, Richard First, Eugene Flynn, Mildred Gooch, Francis Hayashi, Leslie and Joan Inman, Kenny Jackson and Buddy, Helen Kasanoff, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Nelson Mandela, Howard Mann, Tom McGinnity, Adrian Oliver, Jay Pandya, Aunt Polly, Richard Potter, Lottie Powell, Faye Renard, Robert and Helena, Scooby Rodriguez, Dr. Albert Sants, Rosemary Cease, Aunt Barbara Tai, Dion Washington, Dorothy Wirtus, Suzanne Nolan and Neil Williams, Arnie Winant, Judith Wormser, Betsy Yontz, Dorje and Kadro the Pigs.
Okay, good night.